It's Ken Bergen here, and welcome to the Hospo Reset podcast. Each episode, I explore trends, innovation, and smart thinking in the hospitality industry with a particular focus on restaurants, cafes, and food service. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with me on LinkedIn and on Twitter. Hi, Ken Bergen here from Hospo Reset, and today very excited to have Danny Valente along. We're going to talk about food media and changes in the hospitality industry. I just asked Danny how she describes herself, food journalist and podcaster. She's very prolific with podcasting. Her Dirty Linen podcast is just past 400 episodes in, what, a couple of years, I think, already. So that's super. She says her business card describes her as a writer, eater, traveler, and cook. So we're in for a feast for sure. Yeah, let's talk about food media, changes in the industry. I follow Danny on Twitter as well. I think she's probably like me. We find it pretty useful for kind of connecting with things that are right up to the minute. And yeah, anyway, Danny, great to have you here. Really looking forward to this.
Oh, I'm so happy to be on your show, Ken. It's been great. And you were one of the first people to come on Dirty Linen, and I really appreciate the trust that you put in me so early in my podcasting journey. So I'm super happy to be here with you on your show.
Yeah, nice. It's kind of interesting, isn't it, this world of podcasting just exploding. I mean, even the 2 years since you started, it's exploded even more. But, yeah, it's people have a voice and they kind of reach out and share ideas. And sometimes they last, sometimes it fades, but... yeah, people more expressive for sure. Just tell us a bit about your background, your particular interest in hospitality and food, and, you know, how that developed over the last few years.
Yeah, for sure. So writing has always been the thread for me. I knew I wanted to write from when I was a kid, and the topics that I wrote about were sort of less the thread for me. So I've done all kinds of different writing and still do, but I started my career as a writer for Lonely Planet, a travel publisher.
Oh, and okay, nice. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so people, you know.
All around the world or just around Australia or?
I did lots of travel guides for Lonely Planet in, various destinations. I wasn't an expert in anywhere particular, which some of their authors were. You know, they spoke Mandarin or, you know, they had a lot of experience, you know, in France, whatever it might be. I wasn't like that. I would just go anywhere. So I went to some pretty random places. Bulgaria was my first overseas destination for Lonely Planet.
As you do. Ended up,
as you do. It was like, where shall we send the junior writer? Somewhere that she can't get into too much trouble, which actually perhaps I proved them wrong. But, yeah, I did stuff in India, across the US, different parts of Europe, Hong Kong. So it was a grab bag, but it was such a privilege because, you know, you are paid to go to destinations and explore them. So, yeah, it was amazing. The way it segued into food was that Lonely Planet started doing guides to world cuisine. And one day my boss called me in and said, look, Danny, we need someone to go to Turkey to eat. I thought, well,
I am there.
Yeah, I feel like this job's for me. And, yeah, as soon as the world of writing about food, I mean, first you need to discover about food. So it was about eating. It was about asking questions. And I think very early in that food writing experience, I realized that it was a lot of fun to talk to people about the food that meant a lot to them. It was great fun to, you know, go down back alleyways and find, you know, that special noodle that somebody was making, you know, whatever it was. It became instantly something that transfixed me. I'd always been into food.
Any first memories from Istanbul or in Turkey?
Istanbul's like, it's such a world unto itself, and definitely one of the cities when I was there, I was like, okay, I need to come back and live here. This is magical. So one thing I remember, so I was writing a book about Turkish cuisine. I mean, honestly, pretty underqualified, but very keen and enthusiastic and happy to dig in. But there's an offal soup that is sold on the streets of Istanbul late at night. So in the, you know, 2, 3 a.m. is when these stalls set up, especially to sell this offal soup, which is renowned as a hangover cure. So because I'm like very committed to research. I thought, well, if I'm going to test the hangover cure, I need to get drunk first. So did a bit of bar hopping with some, you know, Turkish friends that I'd met, and then they took me to the street stand where they were making, you know, this very pungent lamb intestine soup, which I duly ate and woke up the next morning feeling very bright and perky. So I guess it works.
It works. Magic. Yeah, nice. Okay. So, yeah, lots of travel. And I guess I want to ask you a bit about your quote-unquote production function later too, how you kind of are, you know, so enormously productive, which is something I admire. But I guess you had laptop with you all the time, just constantly fingers on the keyboard and pushing things out.
Well, I mean, that was pretty much, that's 20 years ago. So that was pre-mobile phone and, yeah.
Laptops were big and clunky in those days too.
Yeah. I did. There were some of those early sort of notebooks and stuff that I was using back in those days. But honestly, there was a lot of pen and paper because even if you had something digital to mark stuff down on, you weren't necessarily able to upload it and save it. And sometimes, you know, yeah, it was just easier to have notebooks. So
in those days, grab the ideas when you see them or. Yeah.
Absolutely. And a lot of scribbles. I also had to draw maps for a lot of the Lonely Planet work that I was doing. So that was, certainly easier with pen and paper.
Yeah. Okay. So now writing for The Age and Sydney Morning Herald and kind of very mainstream publications, others may look and think, wow, how did she get there? You know, this is pretty prestigious stuff. You do some fabulous stories. What's the sort of process to, you know, become more mainstream with your journalism?
Well, thanks for the kind words, firstly. Yeah, look, I'm freelance. I've always been, apart from the couple of years where I was on staff for Lonely Planet, I've always been freelance, which I guess means you're sort of piecing together work, you know, here and there. So certainly The Age, SMH, and the Good Food brand that sits under those publications is probably where I do most of my journalism. And I think, you know, it's probably just, I don't know really how do things happen? You just meet people, you talk about stuff, and then, you know, things start to happen. I think for me, it was the way the first thing that I ever did for The Age, because I'm based in Melbourne, was the Cheap Eats Guide. So it was someone actually who'd been at Lonely Planet. They went across to work at The Age. They were two big publishing employers of the time. Lonely Planet's no longer in Melbourne. But they went across to The Age. They started editing the Cheap Eats Guide and they were looking for writers. And so it was just through that. And then I suppose, you know, editors get to know you. I'm a pretty say yes kind of person. So if someone asks
and
me to do something.
And obviously meet your deadlines too, so you become a trusted source as well.
I suppose, yeah, like it's about that enthusiasm and openness to trying new things or putting yourself forward for new things, even if you feel like perhaps you don't quite know how to do them yet. But, yeah, definitely also trying to deliver what the employer is looking for. So, yeah, you know, as a freelancer, I'm extremely deadline driven. So it is, yeah, it's always a bit of a juggle, but it is always about trying to, I suppose, exceed people's expectations, be accurate and fair and, you know, hopefully good to read. So you just try to, I guess, hit all those benchmarks.
I think too that just as a, you know, a reader, you oftentimes, I mean, people are endlessly fascinated in everything about food and hospitality and restaurants. It's just, you know, the voracious appetite for that. But you'll kind of dig deeper, not into kind of like the seamy side or that old, if it bleeds, it reads, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. But it's not like you're after, you know, the ambulance chasing or anything. But you do kind of look at the unexpected and the, you know, it's a bloody tough industry and you seem to have a good eye for, yeah, the sort of the realness of the industry maybe.
Yeah, thank you. I think, you know, I think a lot of traditional journalists saw, you know, the rise of the internet, blogging, other social media as a challenge and a threat. I think I tried to always see it as an opportunity to broaden the space out and I'm on all those platforms as well, so I'm not, I'm into new technologies. But I think I've always used it as an opportunity to challenge myself to differentiate what I do. So what can I do that's beyond, you know, someone who, I don't know, just loves leaving Google reviews or is on TripAdvisor or starts a blog? And I feel like one of the things that I can do is provide context. So, you know, that means if I write a restaurant
review,
I always...
Context.
Yeah, I always get on the phone to the chef or the restaurant owner and, you know, try to understand more about their project so that I can share that with the reader. So it's always, I want to try to give an impression or a verdict on a place that is deeper and richer than somebody might glean just from a very casual visit or just from, a star rating on Google or whatever it is. So, yeah, that's what journalism is, or I think it should be. It's like that you try to put things in context. You know, you leave the person who's reading it wiser or at least more better informed than they were when they embarked on it, and you honour their time in reading what you've written. So it's got to have substance.
Yeah, nice. So let's talk about food media, which is, you know, a big topic. And you've mentioned a few of the new channels that you use and, you know, not feeling. And it's funny, you mentioned food blog. And I'm thinking back, you know, gosh, it's 10 years ago. It's like food blogger, they were these kind of horrifying creatures that, you know, restaurateurs were terrified of. You know, they were wanting freebies and they were bringing gigantic black cameras into the restaurant and disrupting everything. And, yeah, a bit of that's faded because, I mean, other channels have opened up instead. But, yeah, what's you know, in the last few years, what's changed around food media? Because we're going everything from the mainstream newspapers, you know, in real print, through to their digital versions, through to a whole range of social media as well.
Yeah, look, I think it's broadened out and flattened out a lot. I think none of the mainstream reviews have the power that they once wielded. And I think for the most part, that's a good thing. I guess, you know, sometimes, you know, the grumblings from the industry are around, you know, who is qualified to pass judgment on a hospitality business. I think it's tricky because everyone is qualified, honestly. Like if they go to a place, they're entitled to an opinion. I suppose it's about, you know, what they then do with that opinion, and do they think beyond their own likes and dislikes or beyond a particular experience to try to look a little bit deeper into the project of the restaurant and whether, you know, whatever it was they experienced was a one-off or whether it was indicative of something deeper. And I suppose what I mean by that is something like, you know, I would never write a restaurant review that focused on, let's say, the waiter spilling the soup, because I feel like, well, that can happen to anyone and in any place. And it's more like, what does that incident or any other just explain to you about the business's intention and what it might normally be? And, you know, in a sense, it's about, so if they spill the soup, what do they do next? You know, do they care about it? Do they try to make it up to you in some way? Is there a sense of hospitality? So I suppose, again, it's about bringing that context and that deeper engagement with the project of a restaurant to try to, yeah, I suppose give them the, yeah, just honour their project, you know, it's, and then explain that to anybody who might be wondering about where to eat out. But if, you know, most people read reviews just for something to read, not because they're about to go and book the restaurant. So it's also about, it just has to be entertaining in and of itself.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, because I see this with lots of directories, especially new directories starting up. And you just think, oh, you're kidding. That's not people. Yeah, it's kind of almost, you know, what your friend recommends rather than kind of deep research that drives people to kind of what we're going to eat out tonight or something like that. Entertainment's pretty important, I think.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, we are, you know, the micro influencer is really important, and a lot of times, you know, that small engaged audience can be really activated by something that a person says. So, I mean, I don't have any problem with influencers, quote unquote, or bloggers or people communicating on TikTok or whatever it is. Like, I welcome it all. I think it all has its place and it can all be valuable to an audience and a business. And yeah, for myself, I just, you know, observe everything, decide what I want to tap into or not, and I just use everything as a spur to try to be better myself.
Yeah, I saw, actually it was posted on LinkedIn, but the GM of a large organization with multiple venues was just talking about how one of his bar staff who's on TikTok, she's kind of, they're using her as an influencer to get staff. And I love that because, boy, if there's a topic we could go on for hours about, you know, staff shortages and all those sorts of things. But wow, trying something new and it's fresh. And I actually looked at her TikTok channel. It's pretty wacky. It's kind of not for me, but it's kind of communicating strongly and it's really working for them. So good for them. Good on
them. Yeah, all power to them. I think that's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was just asking you about what social media you find most enjoyable and most kind of useful for kind of tracking down information and, you know, ideas for future stories or watching trends and that sort of thing.
Okay. So for restaurants, definitely Instagram, and for issues, probably Twitter. But Instagram is probably pretty good for issues as well. And I think especially over the, you know, the past couple of years of COVID, I think I've done a lot of my sort of, I guess, advocacy and practical information sharing on Instagram, and that's been really powerful. It's been, a lot of engagement.
Interesting.
There.
You know, I've been a Twitter user for a long, long time. I post several times a day, like to post sort of industry information out, and I use it for all sorts of, everything from conflict in Ukraine through to, you know, industry information and all the rest. But I don't see many restaurant people or chefs using it. It seems to they used to when Instagram wasn't a thing, but do you find it useful for industry information?
I do find it useful for information, you know, including your own, definitely for news. But, yeah, I think because Instagram is more visual, I feel like a lot of industry people, certainly chefs, it's just a more comfortable space for them.
Yeah.
And perhaps, if you want to look at food pics and see what's going on in restaurants, definitely Instagram's a more natural fit.
And I guess it's just following on the fact that the people who work in the industry are very visual, and now there's a chance, even though we only needed, you know, a couple of hundred letters or two sentences in a tweet, but it makes sense. What gets your attention? Because I'm just interested, you know, you were talking about the kind of the killer reviews, you know, Tuesday's Sydney Morning Herald or Age reviews, people would be breathlessly waiting and who's going to be reviewed, and someone would be crushed because they only got 12 out of 20 instead of, or, 13 out of 20. It's just like all that. Fortunately, I think that's gone. But there's still lots of operators, you know, wanting to be noticed and, you know, we're doing some amazing stuff here, but no one seems to pay attention or whatever. What are your tips for people to be noticed and, you know, come to your attention or other journalists?
Yeah, I mean, look, you'd be amazed at how many people are like, we don't understand why we haven't been reviewed. We've been open for 2 years. And you think, well, have you written any emails? Like, are you sure that people know about you? So I'd say just do the basics are really useful. Like,
good
send
old email.
Send an email. I mean, I get tagged a lot on Instagram for openings and new dishes or new menus or events, and I welcome that. Like, that is a super handy way for me to see what's going on and to be in touch with people. And I often, you know, like, journalists get the same media releases for the most part, and, you know, everyone likes to, well, I'm not so much into following, like, what's new and hot and all that. So because that's not necessarily my focus, I like to keep up with, you know, restaurants that opened a couple of years ago or 5 years ago or 10 years ago, whatever it is, or more obscure places, because the column that I do in the Sunday Age each week, I can do breakfast, lunch, dinner, fine dining, you know, food trucks, and I can do, it doesn't have to be in a city. I love going to the suburbs. So, yeah, I think that's that stuff that's a little bit off the beaten track. Is Instagram is really great to find that. And I love being, I'm happy for people to tag me in or message me to tell me about places.
What's interesting, particularly interesting, because just, you look at, I mean, that's one of the things about Instagram. Everything looks amazing. And the number of disappointments I've had where I go to a shop or a place is just like, where's that beautiful food I was promised? But what you know, draws your interest as, wow, I must check that out a bit further.
I think it's if there's a point of difference. So I'll look at a menu, and if it's the same menu that you see everywhere, then I'm less likely to be interested. I mean, it happened to me I was just before we got on this call, I was on Instagram. There was a restaurant that was selling some furniture, and another restaurant commented on it, and I was like, I haven't heard of that place.
Oh, they're going out of business, were they?
I think they were just updating.
Okay.
So, I don't think this is a sad story. And this other restaurant commented on it, like, should we get those chairs maybe? And then I was like, I haven't heard of that place. So I looked at it. So there's no outreach here. This is just me scouting around. And then I looked at their menu, and it's a pub in an inner suburb. I was looking at the menu, and I went through exactly this process of is it interesting enough? What are the point of difference? Are there dishes here that I could imagine wanting to write about? So it's like,
Were there? Are there?
Almost, I reckon.
Okay.
Because it's like, it's not like I'm looking for the wacky. It's just that I'm looking for something that shows that it's not cookie cutter. It's
something
not
fresh. Yeah.
Something with a bit of an angle that shows that there's thought going into it.
Can you give people a little more guidance about that? No, not because, you know, they're going to be bombarding you after this. Maybe they will. But, no, but I mean, it's, I know what you mean for myself, you know, a fresh angle, a new sort of take on things.
Well, I suppose it's like if I'm looking at it, if I'm looking at a menu and let's say there's some Atlantic salmon, a pork belly, an eye fillet, a pumpkin risotto, and maybe what else would there be? Some sort of generic.
Vegetarian gnocchi or something.
Well, that's the pumpkin risotto, but some maybe a box ticking kind of pasta. Like,
yeah.
And a kid's menu that's got chicken nuggets and fish and chips and spag bol. Now, you know, that might be a really successful business and I hope they're serving their community really well, but I am not feeling anything in there for me to write about.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it doesn't mean that it's not a worthwhile place. It just means that I don't see a story.
So there's no – you're looking at the food, the menu drove your decision there. What about atmospherics and design and, you know, entertainment and all the other kind of – three-dimensional things. What are the signals that you like to pick up on?
It's probably more looking at a narrative, you know, like is it the kids that grew up in that pub and then 20 years later went back and bought it? Is it a restaurant that was, you know, going out of business and then, I don't know, the local footy team and Lions Club thought it was so important to the community that they banded together and bought it?
Yeah,
or, you know, is it, I don't know, what can we say, like
a, really passionate about their recycling and sustainability.
Right,
And they tell you about it because this drives me nuts. So many people are actually doing really good stuff. They just forget to tell you. They don't even take a photo, you know.
Yeah. Well, people are so busy in their businesses.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes they do forget or they don't see their own story. I guess, you know, I get a lot of media releases from publicists and sometimes they can be quite helpful in drawing out the strands of somebody's story. Yeah. And I think assets, like you mentioned, you know, great photos that lead to, you know, disappointment down the track. But I wouldn't underestimate the value of some good photography, something that
can bring
We've your all got a dishes
camera
to
in
life.
Our pocket too.
Well, we do, but then sometimes the value of a professional photographer and some good, decent lighting. Some people can do it with their phone, but a lot of people can't. Or, you know, just a lot of scenarios perhaps don't work with phone or perhaps some food doesn't work so well with a phone. Yeah, so some good assets, good content definitely helps people stand out. But I think a really good story, you know, a really good story really hooks me in, like a refugee opening their first business and they're still waiting for their permanent visa, you know.
Overcoming adversity in any kind of form.
Yeah, any kind of story is good. Two sisters who, you know, started cooking for their parents' dinner parties when they were 6 and 8 and now they've opened a cake shop. You know, I don't know, I'm just making it up. But anything that you're just like, oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah. I think there's, so many stories in so many places too. Oh, my God, you walk in and you think, oh, my God, they're doing this, this, this. And, oh, really, are we? But anyway.
Yeah, totally. It's like it's the mum's lasagna recipe or the great aunt's lasagna recipe that they got when they, you know, went back to Italy, you know. Wow, really amazing, you know. What does she do with her lasagna? So, yeah.
Yeah. Well,
people are probably a lot more interesting than they think.
Yes, absolutely. And if you're in food and in the food business, you can start from the understanding that you are, and I say this to people, go along to Chamber of Commerce meetings and all those things because I promise you'll be the most interesting person in the room. They want to talk to you, not the finance broker and not the real estate agent.
I love
that. They want to talk to you,
It's a great tip.
Yeah. Let's turn the clock back a little bit to beginning of 2020 and, you know, feels like we're still actually dragging ourselves through kind of COVID and recovery and lockdowns and all those sorts of things. We've learned to be lean and mean and agile and resilient and all those words. Yeah, how did you see the industry? Because I really, you know, hats off to your, you know, the way you documented people's struggle and success through all that very passionately and accurately, I think. What are some of your kind of memories now about how people kind of came through and, you know, survived and things like that?
Yeah, I mean, it has been such an intense couple of years. And if you, sort of turn the clock back a few years, what we've been through is quite unimaginable. And yet here we are. We've all done it. And I feel like one thing it's done for us is we know that unthinkable things can happen. So as you look, as we look forward, it's, I don't think anybody feels like they're really relaxing into any kind of new normal, because we know that life can be deeply unstable. So I think that is something that's really quite marked, and it's actually a big change. It's not like we've just gone through this thing and now we're just, you know, back to it. Yeah. So there's that. I think there's a lot of weariness and probably, you know, trauma that hasn't quite been looked at and unpicked and dealt with. Not for me personally so much, but just for people who have been running businesses and, you know, small businesses and trying to look after their staff and perhaps not looking after themselves as they do that. Mm. So yeah, I think it's really tough. Yeah, like a focus for me right through this whole period was people who are here on temporary visas. And I think a lot of those people are still in, you know, many of them left Australia, some of them moved interstate. A lot of them are still, I guess, regrouping and recovering from a period where things were especially tough for them. But yeah, look, I think in any crisis you see the best of people in so many ways. And we did see people looking after one another, people who are incredibly resilient and nimble and, you know, kept finding new reserves of energy to deal with the next challenge. But I think, yeah, it is, there is a lot of, I guess, depletion out there. And I'm definitely feeling that now. People are really now struggling with the, you know, cost increases and ongoing staffing issues, as well as, yeah, COVID's still out there. And winter can be a tricky time for people at the best of times.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, that's, you know, all through kind of most of 2022 was kind of like, see you on the other side, you know, we'll be back to the good old days. Well, ain't happening. And yeah, there's some people. And, you know, I think from what you said, fortunately, I didn't have a cafe or restaurant to run, but I found, you know, the work I was doing the last few years when I worked with Silver Chef and running lots of webinars and lots of kind of support for e-business operators, I have to say, tremendously exciting, because I was having to do things I'd never done before, and everything, that kind of things I might have relied on as the way to do things before, didn't work anymore. You had to find a completely new way, and there's a whole bunch of new hero stories, which was exciting to track those down as well. Diversification, all those sort of things was,
it's very inspiring. People learned a lot about what they were capable of, and it was really inspiring to watch people innovate and, yeah, bring people with them. I think it was very inspiring. I mean, personally, I learned a lot more about the hospitality industry and how it works behind the scenes. I'd always, you know, loved restaurants forever and always super interested in them. But I guess, you know, for COVID stripped back the layers in so many different ways. And I think for many hospitality businesses, this was the time when they couldn't just be paddling madly underwater anymore. They really revealed some of the truths to their customers and to the broader community, and perhaps to journalists such as myself. So I felt that there were so many stories to tell and voices to platform and elevate that, it's been a very extraordinary and rich time in that sense, in the sense of like connection and people being really open about the journeys that they're on.
Yeah, yeah. Talk to us a bit more about what you observe in the industry around employment. I mean, you mentioned about, and I, you know, used to watch with admiration the work you were doing with whether they're refugees or overseas workers or people who are basically, well, the Prime Minister just said go home, you know, and we won't go into all of that, but that was the level of welcome or lack of welcome. And, of course, now it's, you know, please come back. But we've lost that group. But it seemed to be a little bit emblematic of the carelessness in the industry around employees is something I've kind of watched with alarm for many years, really. We just have very poor practices, but I'm not talking about my dark view of things. What did you see with people who are doing a good job and now people who are actually, because even now there are people who have got the staff they need and people don't leave. Well, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I will just, we won't talk about all the detail of it, but I will just say ex-Prime Minister, and it does feel good to say that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Ken, you have had a lot more experience with this side of the industry over a long period of time than I have, but I suppose the things that I observed were, you know, very divergent. So some people really looked after their staff. And I was chatting to a senior manager in a big restaurant group recently, and he was saying, you know, we looked after all our staff through COVID and we're actually fine at the moment. Like they're struggling with illness and that sort of thing. But in terms of that staffing pool, they are able to, yeah, they've been able to retain most of their staff. Some businesses tried as hard as they possibly could to look after their staff and they just simply weren't in a position to. So, you know, you can only do what you can do. Some, you know, groups who've got a bit of a buffer and can move people around, perhaps, you know, they had some advantages for sure. But even some of those smaller restaurants, you know, perhaps a lot of people were doing takeaway only to look after their staff and their international staff who at least through 2020 weren't getting JobKeeper. And, you know, I found that really, really moving and really inspiring. But at the same time, a lot of people just cut their staff loose. And, you know, it's not necessarily saying they did the wrong thing because, you know, it's a business and it was unprecedented and it was, you know, really alarming. So, yeah, people were in different positions. But, look, I saw a lot of people just do everything that they possibly could to look after their workers. And I saw others be really careless with people's lives and livelihoods. And I don't know if that's human nature or if it's just how people have been brought up in the industry. But even in the last few weeks, I've heard and, you know, been privy to some situations that have been deeply disappointing. But, you know, at the same time, I chat to people who are very well looked after and appreciate some of the, you know, the structural shifts that have occurred in the industry in terms of people reducing opening hours and giving their staff another day off, you know, and some of that's cost driven and, you know, but sometimes a lot of it is just, you know, really looking at work-life balance and, you know, those resets that we, I guess, at the beginning hoped COVID might inspire have happened for many businesses and some people are, you know, they've got more balanced and calmer and happier lives as a result.
Yeah, and hopefully some of the employees have become a little more assertive out of this too. I know certainly, you know, people realizing, wow, I can get an extra 10K a year if I move, and people are finally getting some okay money instead of, you know, below what they should. But it's still, you know, it's always been an amazing thing to me that, you know, you see some chefs who've got tats to the ends of their fingers and, you know, a big buffy bloke who, you know, ready to raise their, and they kind of put up with these incredible conditions of, you know, long hours and ripped off on their superannuation and other things like that. It's just, wow. Anyway, that's a little rant of mine, but
no, it's true. I mean, people should be well paid for the hard work that they do, but I guess, yeah, there's still in some cases, there's still a culture of, well, you've got to put up with a certain amount of stuff. And it's great if people realise that, yeah, that they don't or they shouldn't have to and they do something about it. I think it does, it's, yeah, it is. I do feel for restaurateurs who are like, well, whoa, I really, that manager wants to be paid, you know, 20K more than the last guy. I just don't know how to make that work.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It is tricky. I mean, in the end, it all comes down to finding value at every point along the supply chain, and the buck has to stop with diners in a lot of cases. But at the same time, you know, not every diner has an extra $80 to spend on a meal out. So it's tricky.
Well, I see, you know, the stories now are the $50 main course and all this kind of crazy talk. And I just, you know, I trained as an economist at one stage, and there's this thing called supply and demand. And if prices go up, demand goes down. It's just one of those things. And I guess I'm always, yeah, impressed by people who manage to kind of twist and turn and offer, you know, lower prices still, but the atmosphere is great and it's comfortable and you don't get bill shock at the end. And yeah, maybe it's not the finest cut of meat or something, but that impresses me a lot.
Well, if they've got the skills in the kitchen and on the floor to deliver a great experience, but they're using, yeah, perhaps secondary cuts or more veg or whatever it is, working direct with suppliers, however they can keep their costs under control, I mean, that's just like, that is a golden hospitality experience.
Yeah, yeah.
If they can look after their business so that they can keep looking
after
their customers.
They're going to be here next year. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's a win all round.
Mm. Let's change gears a little bit and come back to talking about you as a very productive person who's doing, you know, lots of writing and several podcasts a week and kind of scanning the industry with kind of your laser eyes to see what's happening as well. Yeah, how do you manage your workflow and, you know, what you push out and managing? I mean, I imagine your email inbox is fairly kind of busy place as well.
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like, I don't know how to answer this because I feel like I'm always scrambling from one thing to the next. I'm very deadline driven. I do have a running list that is, if I'm looking at it now and it's just a bunch
of
scribble.
Is this on a pad of paper or is
it's
it
just
a little,
on the, it's always on the other.
Or something. Or?
Nah, it's just always on the other side of a A4 printout and it's just under all my different all my different hats. So there's a journalism hat or there's three different publications that I'm writing for. So they're separate lists. I do some copywriting. So there's copywriting client list. There's a podcast list. I do a bit of consulting. So there's a consulting list. And then I think something I found out very early as a freelancer was to not keep the home stuff separate from the work stuff. So I have a list that might have something on it, like, you know, walk dog, go to shops, pick up kid, and I get as much satisfaction of, I mean, those things have to be crossed off the list. It's on the same list. I've always worked from home. So I've never been, I think early on, you know, I was like, you know, no, I'm at work. I'm not going to put on a load of washing, but no, it's definitely, it's actually useful. If you're here, why not put on a load of washing or get dinner started or whatever it is? So
I've got soup cooking as we speak, actually. So there you go.
Yeah. It's all a bit of a mad scramble and I don't always feel very organized, but I guess if I look at it, I am actually productive. And I'd say probably the thing that I think I do worst is actually celebrate what I do achieve, because it's always crossing off something off the list and looking at the next thing. But like, for example, today in the mail, I got a cookbook that I've co-written with an Iranian guy, Hamed Aliari. And like, that is so good. Like, honestly, I should take the rest of the day off.
Is it being published or is this a pre-publication or what?
It's coming out in September.
What's it called?
It's called Salamati.
Okay, so I'll get the details from you and we'll put it in the show notes, a link to it, because I'm sure Booktopia's got a kind of information about it there.
Yeah, they'll have a pre-sale for sure. And it's a beautiful book and we worked really hard on it and it's a massive milestone in Hamed's life and it's a real privilege for me to be, you know, to be able to help him write this book. So, yeah, I should take the rest of the day off and bask in that. But actually, apart from, of course, I should do this podcast, but really what I'll be doing when I get off chatting with you is looking at all the other stuff that's looming. So I think probably I should be doing a bit less and, yeah, just sort of enjoying.
Well, the vibe I pick up is that you enjoy tremendously. You get a lot of satisfaction, even though there may not be kind of special award dinners or something like that.
But, yeah, it's true. Yeah. I actually, if I try to think about what I'd give up, I love everything and I wouldn't want to give anything up. And it does all tie in really nicely together. So, yeah, I guess that's just an ongoing freelance conundrum.
And I think, take some satisfaction. You're a kind of an influence for good in the industry as well, too, with the light you shine on things or the way you celebrate good things and maybe just ignore the things that everyone should be ignoring. I think you've got a powerful position there.
Well, I don't know. I just honestly do not spend 5 seconds ever thinking that. I really don't. So I just, I don't know. I just do stuff. Yeah, and say stuff. And sometimes it is, you know, sometimes there's an edge to it where it's something about visa holders or immigration policy or whatever that might be. But, a lot of COVID rules or whatever, maybe there's a bit of a point to it or a bit of a steel to it. But, I definitely, I don't think of myself like that, really.
Yeah. Okay. Well, look, how do people find you and make contact with you? And if they kind of got something they think is, you know, really got an angle and something really fresh and new, having listened to you, what that they want to draw to your attention for possible stories and things, what's the best way to contact you?
They can just, hit me up on any of the socials. I'm just Danny Vallant on everywhere. You can email me through my website. I think, you know, my advice to if you're emailing anybody, but perhaps especially a journalist whose inbox is just like a complete swamp, if they haven't got back to you, just assume they haven't read the email, because there's a lot of unread or vaguely read and not.
What do you recommend people put in the subject line to have a little more chance of you opening it the first time?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose if it's something, if you wanted me to know about your restaurant, then just make it sound unique, or tell me what your point of difference is. I mean, I don't know. Like, I will eventually read it, and especially if I don't, you can resend it if I haven't read it. Maybe let's say in a week. But yeah, apologies to anyone who's messaged me on Instagram, et cetera, et cetera. It's easy to lose messages on Instagram. So definitely if someone doesn't reply to your message on Instagram, assume that they've lost it, because I lose messages on Instagram all the time.
Yeah, I find that the least satisfactory of messaging. But people will, that whatever that's in their hand, they will just use that to message, won't they?
But I do heaps of messaging on Instagram, and I think it's fine, but I get a flood of messages and I lose the ones behind, and I can't remember how to find it. So just feel free to pick up conversations. And I suppose if you want me to know stuff, just like keep it short, but keep it concise. Feel free to use links or feel free to send attachments that aren't too big. But I'm pretty accessible, I reckon.
Yeah. I think that's part of what makes you special, actually. Well, thanks. This has been really a great conversation. Really enjoyed it. Feels like, I'm getting to know you a bit better and helping others as well. And I just really, huge fan of the work you do across for the industry and making the industry stronger and celebrating good things and, giving us a little nudge in the ribs for things where we fall short sometimes. It's terrific. Thank you very much. Thanks for your time.
Oh, I really appreciate the opportunity, Ken. It's lovely to sit down and have a chat with you. And, well done for all the work that you do. And I know we'll be in touch soon.
Nice. Thanks for joining me. I hope you're feeling inspired after listening to this episode. You'll find the show notes and links for today's episode on your podcast app, and look for the link at the top of the hosporeset.com website. Don't forget to subscribe to the weekly Hospo Reset newsletter and connect with Ken Bergen on LinkedIn and on Twitter.